Welcome to the Center for Internet Security's podcast, Cybersecurity Where You Are. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we are at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or even running a state or local government. Join CIS's Sean Atkinson and Tony Sager as they discuss trends and threats, ways to implement controls and infrastructure, explore best practices, and interview experts in the industry. We are here to bring clarity to these complex issues to bring confidence in the connected world.
Welcome back to the Center for Internet Security's podcast series, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'll be going solo this episode as your host, and I can't tell you how excited I am by this episode. So if you don't recall a bit of the history of the Center for Internet Security, we started in year 2000. So we're fast approaching our 25th birthday, and this is a pretty amazing record here in cybersecurity, this longevity and the impact that we've had. So we're starting to think about what are we going to do? Think a little bit about how far we've come and how we got here. So this episode is a bit of a preview of our 25th birthday. And I can't tell you how excited I am by our guests today. We have some of the leading lights, some of the big minds and big thinkers and great public servants that really brought us to where we are today, that had the wisdom and the foresight to think about this cyber problem early and how we bring people together to solve some of these cyber problems that we have in common. So let me introduce each of our special guests in turn here. First up is Frank Rieger, a longstanding government public servant and one of the founders of the company. Frank, if you could just tell the audience a little bit about yourself, just a minute or so.
I've described myself in other similar situation as the ghost of Christmas's past. I've been in and around cyber for, I guess, 60-odd years, 35 of which were in public service at various places where I had a mix of policy responsibilities at places like the Office of Management and Budget and operational responsibilities at places like the House of Representatives and running the infrastructure for the White House. We'll get into more detail as we go on.
Sure. As we used to say at NSA, you were cyber before cyber was cool. So we appreciate the rich history that you have. Next up is an old friend, Ramon Barkeen. Ramon, welcome, and please introduce yourself.
Sure. Well, I'm a computer science math type turned businessman later on. I'm an IBM alum. I spent 20-some years with IBM. Took early retirement and started my own consulting firm, primarily around data warehousing, business intelligence, and some of those decision support disciplines that came from that. Became very involved with cyber through cyber ethics. So before cybersecurity, I was very interested in the problems around computer ethics, and I started the Computer Ethics Institute. We wound up, writing the Ten Commandments of computer ethics. This was back in like 1991. So as you can imagine, very obsolete today, but at the same time, it's still around. It still provides a framework for that ethical behavior. And it was some of those cyber ethics conversations with Alan Paller that then got me directly interested in cybersecurity also. And I've been, as Frank, involved for almost 60 years with IT in general, and at least 40 plus with cybersecurity.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Yeah, as you say, computer ethics, more timely than ever and more troubling than ever, both. So, an amazing career for those that know Ramon. And then last but not least, Clint Kreitner. I often say, Clint, that I knew employee number one of the Center for Internet Security when there was one employee, and you were it. So welcome to the show, Clint, and please introduce yourself.
Well, thank you, Tony. I've had a variety of careers first as a naval officer. And incidentally, I wrote my first computer program, a Fortran program, in 1962 when I was studying a naval architecture postgraduate program while I was still in the Navy. I left the Navy in 1971 and had a 18 or 20 year career as kind of a serial entrepreneur. And that was followed by a period of years as a hospital leader. And my involvement in CIS is 100% connected with my friendship with Alan Paller. Alan came to work for the computer-aided ship design project at the Bureau of Ships in Washington in 1966 or 67. And we were fast friends for many years after that, and engaged during the 1971 to 2000 period, engaged in a number of business ventures together. So that's really the source of, is the source of my involvement in CIS.
Yeah, I mean, so I, no, thank you, Clint. And I'm just in awe of the long and distinguished careers in service that you, each of you has had. But one thing you all have in common, in addition, is you're not really good at retiring. So I'm not sure if I want to follow your example or not, but we certainly appreciate all the work that you have done around the world of technology and service. So when we talk about the origins of the Center for Internet Security, you know, we talk about the Cosmos Club and this sort of gathering of great minds. And we have two of the participants here, Frank and Ramon. And, you know, it's a kind of a neat bit of the storytelling here. But Frank, if you could give, can you give us a little sort of sense of what brought everyone to that room? You know, what was the intent, or how did the invitation look? I mean, how did that group of amazing people come together in that same place?
All of us in one form or another can point to either put the blame on or give the credit to Alan Paller. And I think it's, in my case, it's the former blame. Each of us has a story connected to that. But Alan was one of those people that once you met him, he became, it was for at least, I suspect for all of us, a separated at birth experience. And over time, through regular discussions with him, when I was running the policy shop at OMB, I became aware of and he shared what he was doing, attempting to do by starting SANS. We came to appreciate that there was something missing on the civil side, and that was, if you will, a communication channel through which folks who had good solutions could propagate that information in a way that it was available to those who didn't have them. It actually started at a breakfast at the what was then the Hotel Washington. I think it keeps changing its name, but it's a great place to watch the fireworks on the 4th of July with a third party who sadly is also no longer with us, Jeffrey Hunker, who was then on the National Security Council staff. And we agonized over how we can mobilize, if you will, the civil sector, much in the way that Tony and his colleagues at on the defense and intelligence side were attempting to do. Out of that came the idea of the convening on August 22nd, 2000, that Ramon was kind enough to host.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, I caught elements of that. I had just gotten to know Alan around that time, you know, maybe a year or so before then. And number one, you're right about his sort of magnetism, right, and the thinking. I'm really glad you brought up Jeffrey Hunker's name too, because he was really a pivotal character. But Ramon, you know, you came at this primarily as a technologist, but you were also a friend of Alan, I believe, at that time, right? Sort of in the orbit. And so what was the your thinking? You know, you were sort of more in tune, I think, with the larger world of technology and where it was going. And did it make sense to you, or what was the thought?
This was a very exciting time in IT in general, because in our for the first, I'd say, four decades of IT, it was all about transaction processing. You know, you catch a transaction, you know, you prepare an invoice, you know, and then you store the data. And by the way, the data was there forever somewhere where it was either inaccessible or, you know, there was so much of it that you couldn't do anything with it, with the technology at the time. But around the 1970s, I'd say early 80s, we started to see for the first time advances in the power of the CPUs, you know, the huge advances in storage and the cheapening of storage. And for the first time ever, we started to see some techniques, approaches, and developments in analytical processing, which literally was a champion, if you will, by the data warehousing movement. And once you had the ability to do analytical processing, guess what? Now we were able to go into these vast repositories of data that had been captured, and we could take, you know, the family jewels in a company, in a government agency, and put them in the data warehouse. Well, guess what? You know, now you go back to Willie Sutton, right? So why do you rob banks, Willie? Well, because that's where the money is. So once we start to put that really valuable stuff in these data warehouses, guess what? Now we had a target for, you know, all the bad guys. And that, of course, then married, if you will, the advances in technology with the importance of cyber. And cybersecurity was really an afterthought, if at all, in the mind of the developers. I mean, and that meant the vendors, the people that were out there, you know, producing, you know, the software and the hardware, you know, they never thought about security, cybersecurity, until it bit them in the behind, right? The incident happened, a penetration, a breach. And of course, it was that kind of a situation that really pretty much hit Alan very directly because of his involvement with SANS, some of the things that he was seeing, and also, by the way, his involvement in data warehousing. Because Alan, you know, was very instrumental, as you probably know. We co-founded the Data Warehousing Institute. I was its first president, but again, it was Alan's idea. It was his vision. Again, it brought the importance of the technologies, these repositories of valuable data and data warehouses, and then the need for cybersecurity to address these situations and the growing incidents.
Yeah, that's a fascinating perspective, Ramon. I mean, they're sort of like, you know, computers were transactional calculators, right? Things that sort of automated human process. But as soon as you start to build, value, right, create value like the vault of a bank, but the digital equivalent thereof, then, you know, criminals are incredibly motivated and creative, right? Nothing brings out the creativity of human beings like the opportunity to, you know, to get gain from it. But so, Frank, just a quick summary. So what was the tone of the meeting, and what did you all walk away with? What was the notion?
The tone of the meeting was incredibly collaborative. We had folks in senior positions in government, but also folks from the private sector, from places like Goldman Sachs and other folks from the financial sector. And there was an immediate consensus in the meeting that, if you will, the state of the practice was woefully deficient, that we were terribly exposed. But and there's a basic premise I would argue, in all of the best practices work that CIS has done in the last nearly 25 years, there were folks out there who actually knew what they were doing. Some of them lived in Tony's world, and we had, unfortunately, as a consequence of the politics of the moment in 1987, created a firewall between the defense and civil sector and government. And so a lot of that knowledge simply wasn't being propagated. The discussion, by the way, not your fault, Ramon, but you may recall the air conditioning broke down at Cosmos Club that evening. And notwithstanding a meeting in an unheated space in the dog days of summer, nobody left. But the consensus of the meeting was ultimately around three questions that needed to be addressed. What can I do to secure my systems? You know, how much is enough? You know, what's the standard, if you will, of due diligence in cyber? And thirdly, and SANS comes very much into the picture here, whom can I trust to advise me in these matters? The state of cyber at that time was, as many of us observed, like 19th century medicine, lots of folks out there practicing selling solutions that were not even remotely directed at the problem.
And that formulation of the problem, right? It was, you know, so I grew up in this government techie side of this. And the holy grail was, when will we be secure? You know, what is that? We'll reach some mystical, magical state of being. And we'll do that because, hey, I'm a math guy too, right? So mathematicians are so clever. We'll invent the security. We'll make it a technology solution to this problem. But, you know, for the reasons that Ramon mentioned, you know, criminality, privacy, all these things are social and economic issues. They're not technology problems to be solved. They're really, really much more fundamental than that. And so, but that formulation then was away from the, let's get to perfect security. It's like, what is the expectation? What is a rational, reasonable approach? And that's, I think that sort of discussion, Frank, and that formulation has stuck with us to this day. At least I'd like to think so, that CIS remains, you know, focused on these pragmatic, non-judgmental, like we have to progress, right? And we have to be able to say, there isn't going to be perfection, so how are we going to operate with confidence in this world? So the meeting goes on, the air conditioning or not, that really says something to the participants that they suffered through that. But eventually, this has to turn into something real. And that's where Clint comes in. So Clint, tell me about that call from Alan. How did you get involved in this? Because you weren't actually at the first meeting, right?
Well, Alan happened to call me right after I had retired as a hospital CEO.
Okay. This is about, and you guys. See, you guys are not very good at retiring.
Well, ahead. I retired four times. I think the last one stuck.
Maybe, but you were great at it then.
But anyway, Alan called me. And so we're talking 2000, and I had known Alan since 1967. And we had engaged in a bunch of business ventures together. So a call from Alan was nothing new. And he simply told me, some friends and I are trying to get together an organization having to do with cybersecurity, and I'd like you to come meet with me and a friend of mine called Frank Reeder. And so I did. I came and met with them, and they shared with me the conversations that had been had at the Cosmos Club meeting. And having been involved in a number of startups, that's kind of where I get my juice. I said to myself, this sounds really neat. It's a very worthy mission, an impeccably worthy mission. It's the common good. It's a, what's not good about it? And so I said, count me in.
Wow. And so, I mean, that's a pretty big challenge though. And then you came from a world of technology though, right? So you had a sense of the scope of the challenges in front of you. But so what did, you know, what were the first steps? I mean, was it gather friends, brainstorm a company? What where did you go with that?
Well, as I said before, that Alan was just so key at every step of the way in the evolution of CIS. So Alan provided access to Kara Mueller, who was on the SANS staff. She still is, amazingly, to do some administrative things like sending out invoices and such. He gave us access to his accountant, Jimmy. And there was another young woman named Karen, a young lawyer that was doing something with SANS that helped us a little bit. But at any rate, that was the organizational model. It was Clint and Jimmy and Kara and Karen. And so it obviously the focus was to take advantage of all the contacts that Frank and Alan had, and to try to turn this into a business. And so we had to, we can talk about the business model, which is a fascinating subject. But when you're starting a business, you're all by yourself, you do what has to be done. Everybody does what the team needs to be done. There's no silos at all. It's a highly stimulating experience, and I've been very privileged to enjoy it numerous times. Computer services and healthcare services and so on. So I just loved it. It was, as I said, the mission was so clear and so common good oriented. How could I not love it? And Frank and Alan were just super folks to work with. And we were kind of the threesome, and we went out our weekly meetings and I was busy trying to operationalize things. And benefiting from their advice all along the way.
I could picture those conversations, you know, with the small cast and sort of the outreach and all that. So let me offer you my Allen connection back to the three of you. So around that time, sometime in that fall of 2000, we had a successful at the National Security Agency as an outgrowth of Blue Team, Red Team testing, what we call the NSA security guides. When you look back at it, it's sort of a spiritual cousin of a CIS benchmark. And we were doing it for the DOD and intelligence community. And it appeared as an accident. It wasn't really a planned product. It was kind of a way to capture knowledge, you know, testing that we were doing. And for Windows NT, that's how far back this goes. And the team leader, and many of you know the late, great Paul Bartok, knocks on my door one day and he says, "We're looking at this Windows 2000 thing. It's a whole lot bigger. It's much more complex. And Windows NT isn't going to go away for 10 or 15 years in the DOD. I don't think we have enough people or resources to do the quality of work that we think is appropriate. What do you want me to do about it?" And I said, "Well, Paul, make me a list of everybody in the U.S. government that has something like this. And let's call them all up and partner with them, see if they want to work together." And that, he came up with a list of about 14, and that list evaporated in the afternoon. Because government's really good at getting excited about something as a one-time thing, right? Put some money into it, do a one-time project. And they had all just kind of disappeared, or they'd lost a mission or been reorganized. So I'm scratching my head and going, "Well, how are we going to do this? Hey, I know that guy, Alan Paller. I think I'll give him a call," because Sands had that Windows NT step-by-step guide. I said, "Alan, here's what, you know, what are you going to do about Windows 2000, Alan?" He goes, "I don't know. What are you going to do?" I said, "I don't know, but let's do it together." And he says, "Wow, this is interesting. Let me introduce you to this guy, Clint Kreitner." And so, you know, it all just kind of came together in this amazing, and it was from a government perspective, it was perfect, right? You know, again, we think of NSA as big and bad and lots of resources, which is true, but no one has enough resources to deal with all the technical issues and the complexity of the threats and all the IT configuration stuff. So for me, the great thrill and the selling point to my leadership was the chance to work with a much broader community to share ideas and then codify it in, you know, what CIS then called benchmarks. So this is what brought us all together, the common thread being, you know, one human being and a vision that we could all share about this. So very cool. So let me, Ramon, back to you there. So, but, you know, you've been around some of the biggest companies on Earth, right? Does this make sense for big technology companies? Because again, they have lots of resources. They can think about these problems. They can gather the talent or pay for it. But this idea of this, you know, a consensus across a broad community, did that make sense for the membership model, or was it,
you know, a hard sell? It was a mixed bag, Tony.
Okay.
For the technology companies that were putting out product, you know, anything that smelled of asking them to do something more, something different, implied cost, right? So on the other hand, you know, companies that were big users of Windows NT and other, they also had a problem. So it was a mixed bag, a mixed response. I believe that you had sort of somewhat of the same situation in government. Now, and of course, Frank is a lot better equipped to talk about the government, but, you know, but clearly, you know, if you had, you know, thousands of computers out there and you were responsible for managing them, et cetera, you had the problem. On the other hand, if you were on the policy side or the regulatory side, you saw potentially the CIS as a threat to what you were doing. So anyway.
Yeah, Frank, any thought on that? What would have been, so you had, I mean, there were clearly some leading edge government people involved in that first discussion, but what was the perspective from the government?
Well, there were a couple of sort of principles that guided us in those formative months and years. One was Alan's obsessive concern for measurement and impact. So producing good stuff wasn't enough. We needed take up and we needed evidence that, by the way, some of the work that you ultimately did helped us validate. The second was if we were to have integrity, we couldn't invite the technology companies into the tent. So in fact, we didn't accept membership or support from the folks who were manufacturing and marketing the technology that we were attempting to secure. So it was an interesting model. I mean, we gave Clint this great opportunity to run a company that gave away its product and wouldn't take money from anybody.
Boy, that's a winning formula right there, Frank.
Exactly. I learned in our early discussions with other stakeholders that to be a not-for-profit, you also have to be a not-for-loss. And the business model was that Clint was charged with implementing was, shall we say, slightly challenging.
Sure. And I think, Frank, we still quote you, by the way, on that one there as we go through our strategic discussions at CIS. But yeah, let's come back to Clint on that business model question, because I remember you telling me one time, pulling me aside and going, Tony, I've never run a business where I give my best product away for free. And so how did the business model come to be, right? What were those challenges and how did you turn it into something that could succeed?
Well, a business without revenue is not a business. So we mm-hmm. had to have some revenue, and I have a tabulation of our first 10 years of revenue, expense, and gain, and our cash on hand at the end of 2000 after 3 months of operation was $366,000. Well, we did that. Well, first of all, we consistent with the idea of a collaborative common good effort here. We said really the only sensible business model was a membership model. We're in all of this together. We're all basically putting a little money in the pot for the common good. And so our structure as a not-for-profit, I can't overemphasize how critical that was, particularly with government folks, interestingly. But so with a membership model, a righteous mission, widely recognized, the purity of it all strikes me in retrospect. There was not a hint of self-interest involved. We were doing a good work for the common good, and the only way to get it done was to tap the talents of people who knew how to take these software products that were being delivered with features all opened up, security features all opened up. It was like in my presentations, I often described it as auto manufacturers to giving you a car and you're on your own to buy some tires. If you want a radio or air conditioning, you can go buy that and then plug it in yourself. So the other part of the mega part of reality here was that software vendors were selling products that were totally unprepared to provide any form of security unless there was a knowledge at the end user level to configure all of those security features. So it was also widely recognized what the need was. And so the idea of a membership model, of developing guidance that was based on the consensus of working level cybersecurity people was just, it was like magic. It just flowed. We were giving away the products, but all the people involved in the process were pitching in the form of membership fees, starting with the charter members that we did during the October to December 2000 period.
Yeah, and piggybacking on Clint's comment, the voluntary nature of this went to the actual workforce. The challenge that Clint had was not managing a laboratory in the middle of Iowa with folks with white coats on. It was organizing the intellectual capacity of the user community in both the initial development and then perfecting the what we came to call benchmarks, rather than pretending that we had some independent special knowledge, some secret sauce. The secret sauce was the folks at the end of the network, the user community.
Yeah, I think so. And that ability, you know, and you know, Clint laid out a bunch of the attributes. But go ahead.
Tony, one other thought. We need to give a shout out to Jim Himes from, was it Union Bank, Frank, and our first union in Charlotte? Because Alan, here's another Alan. Alan says, I got to take you to meet Jim Himes. So we drive down to Charlotte, and Jim Himes had established, he was a system administrator, or an overseer of the system administrators in the bank, and he had established a practice of promulgating security or configuration guidelines, what we call, ended up calling benchmarks. And then he also had a scoring capability. And so what he created was this very wise dynamic amongst his system administrators. By every system administrator being aware of what everybody else's scores were, it created this very virtuous competition. And so it drove the process of compliance. And so we owed Jim a great debt of gratitude for that, because that gave us the working model in terms of products and services. And then you combine that with the membership, which is we're all in this together, the not-for-profit, there's no self-interest involved here, and the overall wonderfully, righteous is the only word I can think of, mission, that just, it was an easy sell. It really was.
You know what, and those are wonderful points, Clint. One thing. So when the 20th birthday happened a few years ago, I started the data gathering for all that and pulled a lot of your writings and things that, you know, meeting minutes and all the kinds of things. And what struck me was how astoundingly consistent we have been in these attributes that you talked about, Clint, right? The independence was built in from day one, this community consensus through volunteerism, measurement, this common good, this righteous mission, all that, you guys had kind of all that came together really early. And when I was trying to write clever things for the 20th birthday, I thought, oh, everything clever has already been said about this. And our job is not to create new, it's to carry on. It's to take these and modernize them maybe under different market conditions or technology challenges. And I think that really speaks to the conversation, right? And it wasn't, you know, we all talked about the pivotal role of Alan, but I mean, there were so many brains that contributed. You mentioned Jim, and I know many of the early volunteers who brought great insight and tremendous technical knowledge, but credibility to the process. And so the other thing that struck me about that, your point, Clint, you know, for too long, our industry has created this belief that this is a technology and research problem to solve. But the example of like Jim Himes and that bank and all the things that you did were not about creating new things. It was about applying, right, pragmatic measurement against something and doing it in an automated way, creating this, you know, friendly competition that no one wants to be the lonely antelope at the edge of the cyber herd. So everyone's motivated to improve their scores. And all this been part and parcel of the model of CIS. And I think it really speaks both to the, again, to folks like you, the founders and the early thinkers in here. But, you know, it also speaks to me about the responsibility to carry on, right, to carry the torch for you guys.
Yeah, another thought, Tony, and it speaks to the third of the three questions that Frank articulated. I remember just in every fiber of my being that when I was out making presentations, basically infiltrating myself into domains I needed to be in to let people know about CIS, the totally overwhelming thought was, I need to make sure that we come across as trustworthy. In other words, we were building trust in a world where, let's face it, people can be a little suspicious about things. And the fact that we were a not-for-profit membership model, sharing collective knowledge, all that made it fairly easy to make the case that we could be trusted.
No, a great point. And a word I use today, I know you used it back then too, Clint, was transparency. You know, if you want to have more confidence, come join the team. You know, there's no think tank behind a concertina wire. You know, this is a community product and you can be part of that community, you know, if you can keep up. But it was just so inherent in the model here. Let me shift gears a little bit here as we kind of think about some of the big pieces at CIS, though. And for Ramon and Frank, the role as a company grew, became more structured, and the role of the board, and particularly the decision that brought the multi-state ISAC, Information Sharing Analysis Center, into CIS. I think, Frank, were you and Ramon both on the board at that time and part of that discussion?
Well, the history of the board is interesting because the other concept that our late good friend and mentor, Alan, taught us was the importance of agility. And so the initial board was three people, Alan Paller, Frank Reeder, and this guy, Kreitner, whom Alan vouched for, who was somewhere whom we came to appreciate deeply. But we were the board. And that board persisted for, you probably have the historic record, nearly a decade before we felt it was wise to expand the board to include other wise people. Now, we did cheat a little. We had a rather large circle of advisors. And the reason we called them advisors rather than board members was at least to get government folks involved, having any formal role in the governance of an external organization created ethics problems for them. So we were able to tap this enormous reserve of the kinds of people who were at Ramon's initial convening and keep them engaged without formally putting them on the board. One of the folks in that galaxy was a young guy in New York named Will Pelgren, who was running the Multi-State Information Sharing Analysis Center. And as most of the people who are involved here may recall, the ISACs were the outgrowth of the creation of the Department of Homeland Security and create sector-specific mechanisms for information sharing and even threat management. New York, because Will was the CISO in New York State, stepped up and volunteered to become the host, the home for the Multi-State Information Sharing Analysis Center that supported states, localities, territories, and tribal governance entities. A new governor came into office. These things happen in politically driven organizations, and asked, why is New York State hosting something called the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center? So Will came to us and suggested that there might be a marriage between the mission of the multi-state ISAC and in promoting good practices and CIS, and thus began the process that ultimately resulted in the creation of this second and by no means secondary line of business for CIS.
Yeah, that was, and in, you know, again, as an observer, you know, at that time, still National Security Agency, that seemed such a natural pairing. It might not at first to folks, but this idea of, it's consistent with the idea of we're not writing stone tablets here, right? We're trying to lay out pragmatic real life practices. And part of the ISAC story is we're practicing them. We are fighting to survive 24/7, right, across multiple organizations in a collaborative defense, which was a kind of a, again, as I look back across the history of CIS, wow, these were big ideas. You know, the idea of security benchmarks created by a community consensus was a big idea. It was counter to the marketplace. You know, everyone's got to figure it out on their own. This idea of collaborative defense with an ISAC strikes me as a big idea, rather than, you know, we could exchange some indicators, we could be nice to each other, but this idea of really cooperative defense, right, ongoing monitoring and sharing of data and alerts was a really big idea also. And then I'll just mention briefly, oh, go ahead, Clint.
Tony, just in historical context, that was year 10 of CIS's life, the joining together of the MSI.
Gotcha. So 2000, we can count as the founding. 2010, bringing in the ISAC and as this sort of operational as well as advice giving or benchmark model. And then my role in this comes in 2015, as you all know. In January 2015, I'd retired from the National Security Agency in 2012, took back on the project that at that time was known as the SANS Top 20, I think. And that came into, again, through agreement, friends, board members, and so forth. Came into the Center for Net Security in 2015. And you know, at that time, I think we were talking about 75, 80 employees total. And we're approaching 500 now. So, but these sort of three different pieces, I'll say benchmarks, right? The how do I manage individual pieces of IT to better security effect? The ISAC, the operational defense, right? The management of 24/7 nationwide defenses, and then the controls part of this, which is sort of operational management best practices. And I think have come together nicely and really represent a pretty holistic model in a way to think of this problem, and more by serendipity than by design, I think, that as all these came together. Yeah, Ramon?
Yeah. Now, the one thing I'd like to add with relation to the multi-state ISAC, the board also had to make a decision in terms of, okay, well, is this something good for CIS? Does it make sense? And if I remember correctly, and Frank and Clint, you might correct me, but I believe that the reason why Will got the MSISAC is because he had already managed to take the neighboring states, the New York State, New Jersey, and I believe Pennsylvania, and started to do collaboration among them. And I think when Alan heard some of that story, he saw, this can scale, you know, really nationally. So it was, I think, a much easier sell to the board because Alan had already understood the value. He'd seen the value of potentially having MSISAC under CIS and scale it nationwide.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation, you know, and another example of this, right? We don't have to create magic technology. We need to look around for things that work and figure out how to make them more available, more scalable. And I always said, and I think you guys would all agree, that was one of Alan's great gifts, to be able to look around to find good people doing good things and sort of highlight it, support it, fund it if he had to, connect it to other things. That ability to sort of spot that and then turn it into something of, you know, much greater scale and significance, I think was one of the major contributions he made to our industry here.
And it was a big scale question, because the CIS, and right before combining with the MSISAC, had a staff of less than 10 people.
Right. Yeah.
So the MSISAC was a much larger organization, with much longer history and so on. And so that was a huge, for that was the first time we needed an office someplace.
That's really. I mean, you were certainly pioneers in the work from home, you know.
We simply followed Alan's example. I knew Alan and Marsha when Sands was worked out of their kitchen. So, that 2010 period was a very significant increase in scale.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the enterprise.
So from the, you know, a dozen or less people remote to 500 plus, and we're a work from home company now, but we have significant infrastructure and, you know, sort of traditional facilities also here. So Frank, as you look back on this, I mean, is this what you pictured, or is this, you know, there was a kind of a vision that drove all this, right? Pieces that came together, but you know, you were with the board for quite a few years helping to steer all this. And you look at where we are today, does this make sense to you? We've done, I think I can say with a straight face that the current leadership has really tried to honor those principles that we highlighted. Right, the independence, the nonprofit status, the community building, and all that, and yet navigate a much broader range of activities, much more complex structure to manage in a complicated world, you know, with lots of social distrust and all kinds of other things. But what were you, you know, this is.
Well, I can't speak for Clint and Ramon. I certainly did not envision anything on the scale of what we have as a consequence of bringing the MSISAC and the information and the elections infrastructure, sharing an analysis center into CIS. Certainly, we envisioned that this would grow organically if it made sense. The whole concept, you know, Jen Lute always had a mantra that I wish we could put on all the letterhead. Making best practice common practice was something that I think we were pretty well convinced would gain purchase, or we would. And you know, thanks to Clint's work, and I can't understate the importance of a succession of leaders. Clint, subsequently Will and Jane, and now John, who each in their own way continue to build this trust relationship with folks. As you know, I will now steal shamelessly from you, Clint. This righteous mission isn't enough if you don't have leadership that gains the trust of folks who otherwise could feel very threatened.
Yeah, that's well said, Frank. And again, I think we find ourselves in, with the current leadership at CIS, both reflecting on the past, right, and in my personal amazement and admiration for the clarity of what you guys were trying to do, even if you didn't understand the forms it would take. And I think we've done reasonably good job of honoring those ideals and trying to balance that with the need to have a successful business, right? To be able to have enough income to be able to invest in important causes and grow the workforce and develop people. So I think there's a lot more to be said, and we'll talk about this over the next year or so as we approach the real 25th birthday. But I'd like to give each of you a chance to, any last lightning round statement or sort of last thought about this. There'll be plenty more occasions to talk about CIS and where we've been and where we're going. But I'd like to give you a chance to just sort of, for the purpose of our audience and wrapping up for today's episode, just a chance to think about that. Ramon, I'll let you lead off.
Let me throw in the following, because I think that this is something that it's sort of become a cliche, everyone's talking about it, but I think that artificial intelligence is going to be a very significant disruptive agent in the cyber world and in what CIS does, both in terms of the technology itself, but also going beyond. I mean, this issue of misinformation, which is, I mean, it's partially about technology, but it's also very much, about a whole bunch of social issues. And that is going to, I think, significantly impact how CIS sees its scope. It'll have to. And hopefully the board and the leadership will be up to provide the necessary guidance so that this is done in the right way, so that we continue to be trustworthy, as Clint has very importantly pointed out, but also successful.
Yeah, wonderful challenge. And I know that discussion is starting with us, with the board, with our leadership and our workforce. So thanks, Ramon. Great reminder. Frank, how about you? Any last thought you would like to leave the audience with?
Yeah, I would echo Ramon's comment. All we know for certain is that the world tomorrow will look dramatically different from the way it does today. We see some of the disruptors on the horizon, and there are lots that we probably don't foresee. I've got a concern, and I think it's one that I know the current board continues to grapple with. As the organization becomes bigger, it becomes much harder to be as agile as one needs to be in a world that is constantly changing.
Yep, absolutely true, Frank. Our challenge will be to focus on these principles, right? The things that we have shown we can do, but really apply them in a much more complex problem here. And from trust in technology to, the very fabric of our understanding of what is true or not, it's just an astoundingly important challenge for us socially. Clint, I'll let you wrap us up here.
I think my main reflection is what an incredible privilege it was to be part of this. In a world where it seems to be so hard to get people to agree on things, the idea of a successful endeavor to bring together people of goodwill with the right kind of knowledge to meet the needs of everybody was, unfortunately, rare experience, probably, but it was a very precious experience. And so my heart is filled with gratitude for having had the chance to be part of it.
No, right back at you, Clint. And again, I think it speaks to it's an incredible tribute to the founders, the vision, your ability to execute that, to turn it into, operationalize it, turn it into real work and behavior of the people in the company. And you set the tone for that. So we are every day grateful for, both the ideas, the kickoff, the vision, but also how model that you gave us on how to operate. And we do our best to honor that every day at CIS. Anyway, so as I said, the conversation about the 25th birthday of the Center for Internet Security is really just starting. It's an incredible personal honor for me to be able to talk to the three of you. And we've all spoken of our mutual friend and mentor, Alan Paller, and his incredible role, both with us, but also on the industry at large. So we're going to wrap this up. This won't be the last time that we talk about this topic, and I look forward to the next conversation with all three of you. And with that, to our audience, thank you for your time and attention. As always, we don't take that for granted, and we try to give you some particular insight and understanding of some of the most complex, but also some of the most inspiring and exciting things that are happening in this industry. Please subscribe to the podcast in all the usual ways, and we look forward to catching you for the next episode. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the show today. The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS. If you're interested in learning more about how to grow your cybersecurity program, the free tools available to help you on your journey, or to get involved with the CIS volunteer community, visit our website, cisecurity.org. Start secure and stay secure.